Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona, 1-800-NEXT-STEP. That's 1-800-639-8783. Or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your host, Big Waz, a.k.a. Wozny Lambre. Or did I just flip that? I don't know.
It's been a
long week, y'all. But welcoming back our brother and comrade, Michael Jamal Brooks. He took last week off, and now he's re-energized. He's like the Energizer Bunny today, y'all.
Yeah.
And, of course, as always, my other brother, Nando Vila. What's up, y'all?
How's it going, brother?
Good. On today's show, we're going to get into sort of the branding and marketing problem of abolish the police, which I think ties back into the branding and marketing problem of Black Lives Matter 6 years ago, where like it literally took 6 years for people to figure it out. And, you know, but first we want to talk about the race in New York 16th for the House of Representatives. The Democratic Party establishment has circled the wagons for Gelman in opposition of a young black
Elliot Engel.
In opposition of
was that Knish owner you met once?
What was that?
Gelman.
I have no idea where I got that from.
Gelman's in Queens.
Gelman. I don't know why I said that. That might be a Seinfeld character, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Love the Knish.
You know, in opposition to Jamal Bowman, young black dude, former school principal in the Bronx, you know, a progressive guy, basically for all the things that people like us on this show stand for, you know, and the party establishment, not just
endorsed by Bernie Sanders.
Endorsed by Bernie Sanders, of course. That goes without
and AOC.
And yeah. AOC, that goes without saying. That comes as no surprise. But of course, who's circling the wagons for the establishment candidate, the entrenched 30, the guy's been in Congress for 30 years, y'all. Like, I mean, at a certain point, do you need to do any job for 30 years? Like, serious. Like, I'm not even just saying that because it's convenient for me to feel that way. 30 years in the House of Representatives, the Black Congressional Caucus has endorsed him. You know, if we're going to be fair here, the Teachers Union in New York has endorsed him. I just think I wanted to talk about this today, guys, because I think this is emblematic of all the things that are wrong with the party today. There's literally no reason to be excited about this incumbent candidate. And this is the party that claims to care about progressive politics, claims to care about diversity, claims to care about representation. Literally, like, it's all phony. It's just like, what's the point of this dude? Like, Jamal Bowman is what these people claim to care about, embodied, right? Like, all of the, you know, and I saw it, and you know what I think is funny, when these guys, the Chris Matthews types, choose to weaponize these issues, right? And they talk about, well, Bernie's just another old white guy. Yeah. When they choose to weaponize these things that they're faking it. They don't actually care about. I just remember that being used as a weapon against Bernie during the campaign. And now I don't hear it from any of these people in the establishment, right? Like, I remember on MSNBC, all of these, like, you know, centrist Dem types, like, well, it looks bad that, you know, Castro and Cory Booker and Kamala Harris aren't getting the traction they deserve, and Bernie's just another 70-year-old white guy, and blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, bro, this is where it starts, though. In order to be developing future candidates for important positions, in, like, you know, maybe sometime in the future, if things go well with Jamal Bowman, he can run for a Senate seat. Maybe he can run for governor of New York. Maybe he can do, like, this is where it has to start. And so this idea that the power apparatus of the party has lined up behind this incumbent establishment candidate is just annoying to me, Nando.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, whenever they try to weaponize identity, just always know that it's always in bad faith. They don't actually care about even the narrowest form of diversity, right? They don't actually care about it. They only use it as a way to absorb progressive energy and spit it back in our faces, right? Because, I mean, I think there are plenty of well-meaning people out in the world who say, like, yeah, we should be more diverse. Like, and of course, we should be more diverse. But when it's coming from these people, when it's coming from the party leadership, when it's coming from the media establishment, it is always disingenuous and in bad faith. I mean, this is Elliot Engel is an old white guy. Jamal Bowman is a young black guy. Elliot Engel has been endorsed by Hillary Clinton, the Teachers Union, the Congressional Black Caucus. You know, like, the Congressional Black Caucus is endorsing this old white man over a young black man. You know, it goes to show that, like, the party power structures only care about power. They don't care about any of the issues that they pretend to care about just to basically mostly shame people into voting for them. Right. So, yeah, this is just like there hasn't been a more perfect distillation of something like this in a long time. And this was just like, this is absolutely perfect. And Jamal Bowman, he's a good guy. I mean, like, you know, you watch some interviews with him. He's the real deal. He supports all the things, like you said, that we support. He supports the Green New Deal. He supports Medicare for all. He supports an end to violent empire abroad. You know what I mean? Like, which
God
Elliot
forbid
Engel,
you is, support that in the Democratic Party.
Yeah, seriously. Well, and especially Elliot Engel, who's the chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee since 1994, and, like, one of the most conservative Democrats on foreign policy in the entire Congress.
And hold on, Nando, before you go on, and I think it's important that we highlight that, because, again, and I want to make sure everybody who's listening understands, because a lot of times we're going at a certain pace and we expect people to understand what we mean by an establishment Dem, conservative, centrist leaning Dem. Like, this is what we're talking about. This dude chairs the House Foreign Relations Committee, right? cleared the budgets and voted in favor of every single foreign intervention, every overbloated, overdone military budget under the sun since 1994. Like, this is what we're talking about when it's like, there needs to be a new way of thinking about how to be a Democrat, dude. Like, yeah. You don't, like, and I understand, honestly, in the 90s, this knee-jerk reactionary idea that, yo, we need to sort of, you know, the sort of dick measuring contest of violence. We need to support the police state here domestically. We need to support every single war abroad. We need to show that as a Democrat, as a liberal, that we're strong and we're not limp wrist liberals and blah, 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 blah. And like so much, there's so much of that still in the party, yeah. Even though everybody, you know, you poll the country about Iraq, Afghanistan, even stuff like Libya. Shit. Like, people are like, that was terrible. Why did we do that? That's a terrible idea. Like, even as the country moves past that, there's Dems like this dude, like Elliot Engel, who still get some type of clout, some type of respect within the party, and that's his main thrust. Sorry, Nando, you were going.
No. I mean, you hit it right on the head. I mean, this guy voted for the Iraq War, you know, and it just goes to show the AOC thing. AOC defeating Joe Crowley in her primary was an absolute kind of earthquake inside of the Democratic Party establishment. It terrifies them. They were like, they've sworn a blood oath to never let that happen again. And they will go to the mattresses, no matter how awful whoever it is the incumbent, they're just going to go to the mattress for him in the face of a progressive challenger. It's just, you know, it's important people to understand that this isn't about the issues. This isn't about, you know, any of the things that this is supposedly about. It's about power. And it's about them maintaining their own power. And there's an implicit agreement between all the Dems. It's like, you know, we'll protect you. No primaries, but we'll protect you. Like, you play ball and we'll protect you when the time comes. You know, like, no one's going to challenge you on your left if you play ball. And you know, we're going to throw all the party money behind you. We're going to throw the institutions of power behind you. So, yeah, this is like a perfect example of all that's rotten within the political system, within the Democratic Party.
Yeah. I mean, Elliot Engel is there for anything Israel wants. He's there for coups and, you know, pushing coup in Venezuela. He's there for the real estate industry. The other thing that I think helped make this race a real race, you know, there's a lot of great people running these kind of left challenges, but Jamal Bowman is definitely in a different category, I would say. Like, he is young, but he isn't, you know, there's a lot of like cool, really young, kind of like, you know, people like us, you know, kind of green, like 20s, whatever. And that's great.
He ran a school.
But he ran a school. I mean, this man has like also very real and very significant life experience. And it really comes through in his poise and his leadership. But the other thing, you know, Elliot Engel shot himself. I mean, Elliot Engel went to a Black Lives Matter rally in the Bronx, got caught on a hot mic. And it was a very much a sanctioned rally. So he's there with the Bronx borough president, other kind of bigwigs in the local Democratic machine. And you can hear him through his mask saying, I need to get up there and get some speaking time. I wouldn't care, but I have a primary.
Please bear with me. I'll announce everybody. I appreciate you coming. But then I got to then go down the list, and it's just too many folks here.
If I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care.
Say that again?
If I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care.
No. Don't do that to me. We're not going to do this. We're not going to politicize this. Everybody has a primary. You know? I'm sorry.
Literally says, I wouldn't care, but I have like a real challenger. So, you know, I think, yeah, this one's really important. I just also think it gets to like everything you guys said. And, you know, even while we were in the middle of this, you had this like very embarrassing and paternalistic, like even people who didn't support candidates like Harris and Castro felt the need to write these like embarrassing, ridiculous things. And, you know, and even at the same time, while they were, you know, just endlessly smearing and lying and just being totally disgusting with Bernie, and then by extension, like every single working class and poor American, They, you know, they were cool with Biden. So, like, you know, it's, you know, they were totally fine with Biden. And I just think the irony is that this sort of like shallow, fake diversity politics that the Democratic Party leadership pushes forward. One, of course, they're totally insincere, obviously. And I mean, that's a given. And this is like a great example of this, because look, let's be honest. Like, look, diversity is extremely important. And by the same, you know, on the flip side, obviously, like if, you know, Jamal Bowman was in Congress and Elliot Engel was challenging, you know, or I should say, if it just so happened that Elliot Engel was actually like one of the most progressive anti-real estate industry people we had, real estate and arms manufacturers or whatever, found like a young educator or attorney who happened to be a person of color, obviously we'd support Engel.
100%.
But what makes that like doubly sick, though, is that if you ever built a politics that was about labor unions, that was about working people, it would necessarily be deeply diverse and very much more likely than not led by, you know, a person of color, just because of the demographics, because of the overlap
between Bronx
and racism. it's triply cynical, because one, of course, they don't mean it, even in their own terms. Second, it's like embarrassing to actually say, like, because again, if you just follow the logic of it, it's like, hey man, what are we doing not supporting, like, you know, fucking Alan Keyes back in the day? He was running in the Republican primary. He was the only black candidate for president. I mean, obviously we needed to support him. Or, you know, Carly Fiorina, like, she was the only, you know, we haven't had a woman president yet. Obviously we need to support her. Like, you know, that just one dimensional logic. And then what they're actually actively fighting against, by fighting against candidates like Jamal Bowman, who actually represent people, is something that automatically and necessarily would be like the Workers' Party in Brazil is extremely fucking diverse.
Right.
Of course. Represents workers. And yeah, because of similar traditions overlapping with slaughter of indigenous people, slavery, systemic racism, and capitalism, those things overlap a lot. So if you have like an actual movement and party that's rooted in it, it's necessarily going to be hugely diverse and have the appropriate and best leadership, which is of course going to be include a lot of people of color. So I don't know, man. It's wild. It just fails in every single way. And it is still kind of funny, though. Like, occasionally you see people, you know, surprised that Hillary Clinton would do this. And I mean, if you're surprised, I don't even, you know, I guess I'm getting grouchy because I'm just like getting to the point where I look at the shit that people obsess about all day and the things they think about and the controversy they try to generate. And then, you know, in ways that are, you know, are moralistic and stupid and sometimes honestly just like insane mentally. And then there's still this like fucking fragility out there. Like, oh, I thought Hillary Clinton cared about that stuff. Hillary Clinton, you know, yeah.
Nah, Hillary Clinton.
This is the only race that she's weighed in on so far. This is the only race that she, out of all the races, the only race she's weighed in on has been to endorse Engel over black
and
man.
And you know,
it's
the
perfect
one thing, like, people over the years, the biggest critique of Hillary Clinton has been her quote-unquote inauthenticity or lack of authenticity or whatever you want to, however you want to phrase that. I think all of us on this call could agree that the most consistent thing about Hillary Clinton's political career has been her hawkishness. Like, literally from morning to sundown of her political career, she has been a hawk straight up and down, like from the Senate to Secretary of State to all of it. Like, that's been the through line of her politicism. It's military intervention, whenever. And that's been consistent. So the idea that she would be really into this dude should come as no surprise to anyone. That she would. And it's so funny. It's like, I don't know, maybe the older people in this, I don't claim to know the demographics or much about the 16th in New York, but like maybe she's got a lot, Hillary Clinton has a lot of credibility with the people in that district. I don't know. But like part of me is just like, how much political capital? Local mob
killed Jeffrey Epstein for them?
Right. Right, exactly. How many, what is the extent of Hillary Clinton's, political capital at this point?
Well, I mean, I think she still carries a huge amount of sway with the party leadership,
right?
You know, writ large. You know, right. The Clintons are, you know, the Clintons are almost like a giant corporation at this point, and they have a lot of influence in media and in the politics and in the business community
Do you mean the rank and file workers in the Democratic Party in New York City?
I think there are many Democrats still like the Clintons. I think there's a ton of people who, again, they're not necessarily highly online. Maybe they're a little older, but maybe they're not even that old, who aren't in all this mix. Right. And they definitely love President Obama. I think they like Joe Biden just fine. And still dig the Clintons.
Right. And I think because it's something we should tap into, the congressional.
My grandmother in Florida, man, I'm sorry. I'm just a regret. She just loves President Obama, man. Really likes Biden. She's a union, so she's got a little bit of like fuck you to the Clintons, but not really. Right. Like not like you.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. I just want to get you guys to just expound upon what it means for the Congressional Black Caucus to endorse this candidate. Me personally, I think it speaks to, you know, the entrenched factions are gonna always support the other entrenched factions. The idea that the Congressional Black Caucus wouldn't come out for Jamal Bowman when they couldn't come out for Barack Obama at first. Like, they supported Hillary Clinton, right? Like, they always, always, always knee-jerk will go with whoever has been there the longest. Because, honestly, you know, just by the average age of the Congressional Black Caucus, it's older Congress people, like, they're older. They've known these people longer, and they're just gonna toe the party line, the loyalty line, and dig on whoever is the most entrenched person faction in whatever the race is. Sort of want to get you guys' thoughts on it.
Yeah, I mean that's basically it. Is like the Congressional Black Caucus at this point is basically like a patronage organization, and they need to maintain their power. They need to sort of maintain the other power structures, which it's like I scratch my back, you scratch yours, you know, or however that expression goes, you know. But yeah, it's not anything other than that at this point. It's just another node of power within the Democratic Party establishment. Therefore, they will protect the existing Democratic Party establishment over anything that can upset that, even if it goes against their stated mission. Yeah, it's just as simple as that.
Yeah, and I think the other element too is, again, you know, just understanding.
Hold on,
that
Mike. Before you go on, do we think that he would have courted their endorsement if he wasn't running against a black dude?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think so. I think there's enough diversity in that history.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think he's – I mean, the truth of the matter is, though, is like I think he has not ran a competitive race, I want to say, since like 2000.
Wow.
Yeah, it's been a million years.
I'm sure he fundraises seriously, but I mean, this guy, and you can see it. I mean, you almost feel bad for him when he's debating.
He's like tired.
Yeah. He's not here.
He doesn't want to be there. I mean, what he said on the hot mic, he was like, the thing is also on the hot mic, he had to say it twice because the guy couldn't even hear him. But he was like asking for a slot to speak. And then he's like, and the guy's like, listen, I can't do it. There's a lot of people who spoke already. We can't put you in. He's like, no, come on. If I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't give a shit about this. And the guy's like, what? And he's like, if I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care. You know? And the guy's like, oh, don't give me that shit. Get the fuck out of here. Like, you said it twice.
Yep. Being an absolute asshole. Completely, like.
So good. The fact that he had to say it twice is so perfect.
You know, it was literally twice. It was like, yeah. No, you don't understand.
I never primary. We wouldn't give a shit about these black people.
So I need to tell all of these black people that I care about them being murdered by the police, even though statistically.
Right. There's more black on black crime than police on black crime.
What I don't understand is why isn't there a rally for black on black crime? But anyways, I have a crime. So I have to talk.
Because I do want to move on to the
real quick.
Yes, go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
Kianga Yamada Taylor has a good piece in the New York Times, though, about the challenge inside black political leadership and the different waves of that. And, you know, it's very interesting. Like, there's this great book by Cedric Johnson, I think, called From Revolutionaries to Race Leaders, which kind of talks about like the energy that turned into the 70s and this wave in the 70s and 80s of black mayors. And it's not even, I mean, some of them were good, some of them were bad, but the reality is that because of where the world economy was going, and the ongoing legacies of racism and segregation and all of these other dynamics, like, you know, you all of a sudden had mayors coming in and they were the ones who were like cracking down on unions, cutting budgets and everything. So there's that one. And then you've got this, like, you know, San Francisco, DC, Atlanta, this Gen X. I think 2 out of 3 of those mayors, maybe 3. I know San Francisco and DC mayors both endorse Bloomberg. You know, that's just ludicrous. But now, you know, Kianga was saying, like, emerging from these movements and, you know, from like the left wing of Black Lives Matter, there's a new, you know, potential challenge inside the black, you know, inside black leadership too. So I think, like, not only are they not, like, they're looking out for him because they're all part of like the overall Democratic machine. And I think they're also like Hakeem Jeffries, who's younger. I mean, he tweeted out, I don't even remember which one it was. It was one of these challenges. He tweeted out, like, you know, one down, such and such more to go. Like, you know, fuck you. You know, we're the same team.
And before we move on from this, Nando had shared a screenshot of the Angle for Congress Twitter account where the Biden Brigade said, listen up. HRC is with Engel. Nancy is with Engel. Schiff is with Engel. Cuomo is with Engel.
Just the worst people in the world.
And Engel says, let's go. So, yeah. You know,
so you have a few extra dollars, chip contribution to Jamal Bowman.
Actually literally just donated
a little bit of bread to Jamal
Bowman. Just on Earth. Honestly, just talking to you guys just now, like right now in the last 20 minutes, was like, yo, let me send this guy some bread, man.
It would be legitimately like very, very good
it
news.
It would be amazing.
At a time where there is no good news. There is no good news around.
To you knock know, this that is fool like, off. All right, moving on. And we talked about this briefly on past shows when we just talked about the uprising in the streets in the different communities all across America and just the language that's come out of all of this, right? The killings of, you know, Ahmaud Arbery and George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and all of these people. Just the concept of abolish the police, disband the police. We've seen it in Minnesota already where the chief actually gets up at a press conference and they say, so what happens if somebody gets robbed right now? And she said, we don't know. Which I just thought was just like, Woo, 2020 is crazy. You know what I'm saying? Like, the idea that a police chief could get up at a press conference and say that. And that's just where we're at, you know. I did want to get into it with you guys because I think the problem, it's the problem with everything that we try to get done on in the Democratic Party, but just on the left more generally, is that the coalition is actually broad. Like, mm-hmm. there actually is a broad coalition. And so to focus a message, to make a message concise that actually satisfied the breadth of the coalition is so much more difficult than it is on the other side, because getting a bunch of white people in line is just easier. Even if you're talking about young, old, middle-aged white people, when you talk about the age range of black, brown, Asian people, indigenous people, and just, you know, just the differences in those cultures and those communities, it becomes a lot more difficult to focus a message, right? And so I brought up Black Lives Matter earlier because in 2014 or 13, when the movement or the sloganeering of the movement on the streets started happening, I remember in real time thinking, and I don't know if I even said this on any of our stuff, was just like, look, obviously I get Black Lives Matter, but if your messaging is such that every time somebody who's not completely with it and hip to it hears it, they recoil and immediately want to be against it, immediately want to rebut it, immediately want to be like, what the fuck is that? You know, your message didn't work. You know what I'm saying? Like, the messaging, the marketing of the messages, it didn't work. And we're 6 years later, and now Roger Goodell can get up, you know, in his living room amongst his leather-bound books and, you know, unequivocally and no hesitation say Black Lives Matter. Like, yeah, 6 years later, but I see the same things happening. I say all that to say I see the same things happening with Abolish the Police. The messaging, the idea when, you know, middle-aged, suburban, even, and I want to say even non-whites, like if you mm-hmm. are a professional class non-white and you hear, wait a second, ain't gonna be no police? Like, you're like, hold up now, like, wait, like, did we think this thing through? And so I just wanted to talk to you guys about how to better market this message in this movement, because I think there is a will to have a less aggressive, less ridiculous police department all over the country amongst a broad demographic of people. But I want to know how the message can be better communicated.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, I do agree that Abolish the Police is like a, you know, just a political non-starter. I mean, I think you're just, I mean, it's just, you're not going to, I mean, you're not going to get anyone outside of like an incredibly tiny fringe of like academics or NGO types or whatever. I don't know. Like, Abolish the Police just seems like a very obvious, like no one is going to be like, what?
We gotta think, you know, about like, the last two things we abolished in America was liquor and slavery.
And slavery. Yeah.
Like, yeah. Like, and obviously we ended up bringing liquor back. And some would say slavery, but whatever. You know what I'm saying? But I'm just
I don't know why that's so funny to me.
Brought it back. Brought it back from the dead.
Bringing so back the mic.
We went back on the
second. How do we make it so that we don't go back on the third? No, I'm just saying, like, when people hear those words, that's what they closely associate with.
That's true. I mean, it's what it is. It's plain English. I mean, Abolish the Police means, like, there's no police. And then, yeah, I think that the next question is, well, what happens when someone does a bad thing, you know? Like, and they haven't come up with a really good answer for it. I mean, I think that the pivot towards defund the police I'm fine with it. I mean, I think that it's, you know, this idea of like right-sizing city budgets that are like, you know, have these giant police departments and then no other social services. I think that implied in that word is like, it's not like an abolishing thing. It's like, you know, defunding any sort of program is like you cut the budgets and you know, you look at these cops and how, how they're armed to the teeth. I mean, that's money, right? That's money flowing to police departments, and that they shouldn't be getting money to do those things. That seems pretty obvious to me. And then the other question, I mean, I think that there is something worth talking about in terms of like dissolving certain existing police departments and then kind of starting from scratch. I think I'm fine with that. I understand that when an institution has such a culture ingrained into it, like reforming institutions like that is just unbelievably difficult, you know? So like, I understand the idea of like, yeah, we shut down the existing police department and we build something new. And under new auspices and new metrics, new everything, you know. But yeah, abolish the police. Just this idea that we will live in a society with no crime and no police. Like, I mean, it's just I think that's just an absolute non-starter. I think that we have to talk about the nature of policing. You know, I think there should be police that are out there solving crimes. You know, like.
And another problem that I think we have that needs to be mentioned is that. The word police reformed is already taken.
Well, they've tried a million things.
Like, that term, though, as it pertains to sensitivity training and all the other bullshit that they came up with to reform these cats. But like what we're talking about is like reform. It's like literally top down changing everything.
But right? That's where. So I just want to say, because I know, because we'll get some. I said on the weekend show with Anna that I'm not at police abolition yet, and I know some people are, why?
No, I mean,
and I just want to say, like, look, I definitely, like, look, there is the End of Policing, the Alex Vital book. There is this very broad, like,
she's good.
Miriam Kaba, obviously, in the New York Times, and at Prison Culture on Twitter, and I actually really enjoy Ruth Wilson Gilmore, specifically on prisons, and some of this flows back to, you know, definitely Angela Davis, obviously, and the idea of the prison industrial complex. So I mean, I want to acknowledge that there is like a real serious history here, and it's interesting because it's like, okay, so everything you guys just said, 100% right. Like it isn't like. This isn't something that you're going to sell to the masses. And I want to loop back in a second to what that city councilwoman said in Minneapolis, which I did like a 20 segment on because I thought it was such a disaster. But
yeah,
I think that, you know, what strikes me is that I guess one, like the big ticket point is that there's things that need to and must, and I think can, with the right amount of struggle, be done now on policing because it's an emergency that's existed for ages, and this movement is fighting to address it. I think like the bigger like we want to really demobilize that kind of militarization and carceral state of society. Like, I'm sorry, you can't separate that from public works projects, healthcare, housing. Yeah. That's where like the work of people like Cedric Johnson come in, and who I'm again, really big admirer of like, the reality is we have no social infrastructure in this country. We use police to monitor and terrorize communities of color, poor and working class communities, because we have consigned tens of millions of people to completely, to
permanent underclass.
Yeah, a permanent underclass that we so like that. Those are all the issues that are tied up in it. I think the other two things, though, that are kind of interesting to me is like one. When you get into this stuff, I mean, on one hand, like a guy like Alex Vital will say, like, obviously tomorrow we're not going to snap our fingers and get rid of the police. There is going to like be some of that function. So then all of a sudden it becomes much more relevant and much more like, yes, like, of course, like, absolutely, like the ideas around like, you know, demilitarizing the police, getting them out of schools, having social workers respond to mental health issues and all of that type of thing, which is totally obvious and can be done today. So even someone like Vital, who wrote The End of Policing, says that. Then, I mean, on the other hand, like I think it's also, though, useful, especially because, I mean, we won't really get into it, but I think it's interesting that some people who are like, the most like insane, like vicious, like hall monitor cop, like, we're going to create a new culture. No one's ever going to make a mistake. No one's ever going to be a human being. No one is ever like, and I'm going to do all this shit and nonsense and toxicity on social media, that there's some overlap of interest with like ending policing. And so it's like, wait a second, like, are we like ending policing? Like, we have a genuinely much more resilient, compassionate society, or are we sort of like transforming policing along different lines? You know what I'm saying? And so that's another thing. But real quick, like the woman in the Minneapolis City Council, and by the way, I love Shama Sawant, the city councilwoman in Seattle. She is so on point. She's doing serious work right now to support the protesters, to ban tear gas, like all this stuff. And she was like, why are you giving like Minneapolis so much energy? They made this big announcement. Now they're going to study it for a year and it's going to be mothballed and nothing's going to happen. So I love that she said that. We don't know what Minneapolis is going to do. And honestly, the way the trajectory of things are now could end up way worse. But the point was that when the city council president was asked on CNN, what happens if like, you know, someone's breaking into your house or whatever? She's like, well, I think you're going to like, some people are going to have to like check their privilege about that.
Yeah, no, come
that
on.
That was so Jesus fucking Christ. Demented, both in terms of selling the issue, but also
morally,
in terms of, like,
yeah.
And I always go back to Cornel West. Like Cornel West was like, the racism of policing is about democracy. Every single person wants security and democracy. And so and that's like not even just a question of selling. That's like the truth. Like we've talked about, like it's fucked up. Like, okay, go in, terrorize this black and brown community on, you know, petty nonsense, write people summons, beat them, harass them. And then on the other hand, ooh, serious crimes, less of a priority. So like—
Well, it's not just that, but it's privilege to care about it or whatever.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden, instead of getting into like, everybody needs public good provisions and a full, serious, actual multiracial social democracy, all of a sudden we're using privilege discourse, which by the way, all that will lead to is fucking private paramilitaries that people pay for the privilege of private security to protect. Right. And that's even worse than where we are today.
Well, AOC's line was even bad on it. Like, I mean, AOC was asked about it. She's like, well, it's easy to imagine that. You just look at the like a rich white suburb and it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Rich white suburbs have very big police departments. Like the Beverly Hills Police Department here exists and it's well funded, and you know, it's you know what I mean, like they're not living without police. You know, they're enforcing sort of boundaries and all that stuff, but it's almost like an internal border or something, but they are very policed. It's different than it's not like some sort of abolitionist sentiment. It's just not the case.
Because again, even in Beverly Hills, they like, you know, some of the riffraff tends to get blown in here with the wind. Yeah. We need somebody to clean that up.
Yeah, they have police for that. Yeah.
Because, and you know what's so funny, Nando, is a while back, I went to a house party in Beverly Hills. It was like this big, they rented a house and it was like an outdoor type of thing. They had all this land or whatever. It was like sponsored by some tequila company, all this crazy shit. And inevitably at 2 a.m., they break it up or whatever. And, you know, the cops are just outside.
They came with aromatherapy. They were social workers.
But the cops were outside.
DVD oil.
The cops were outside. It's just like, you guys called your Ubers? You guys ready? You guys this? They were just chilling. They didn't give a damn. They were just like, yeah, guys, just make sure you get your Ubers. Make sure you this. All right, you cracking jokes. They were, I was trying to imagine what that would look like in New York. Oh boy, it just wouldn't go down that way. Or like when you're in Manhattan at a club and that club is known for having black people there, and then the cops show up on horses. Like, you know, it's just a different sentiment and attitude, bro. Just different.
They show up on horses,
but it goes to show
one, like, we're tired of being treated like dogs.
It goes to show that police enforce the existing social order, right? So, like, in the suburbs, it's not like they don't have police. They just have a police that enforces that existing social order that exists within that suburb. So, like,
and they have tons of private security, too.
They do. They often do. Yeah. But that's, I mean, that's why I think like all this talk, like you said, Mike, has to be coupled with a expansive view of really rebuilding the state as a means to provide basic social welfare for all, reduce inequality, you know, all those things, like, because that's it. Once you do that, the police will behave like police are supposed to. Like, right. That's just the reality, you know, like, but this idea that even in that world, even in a world in which we got Medicare for all and a Green New Deal and, you know, massive new green jobs program and fair housing for all that stuff, you know, there'd still be crimes and there'd still be murders, right, and domestic disputes and, you know, husbands will beat their wives. Like that stuff will still occur. It'll happen less.
Right. Yeah. Like, because everybody knows that. So, like, what are we actually saying? You know?
Right. Exactly. Like, no one believes that that will end crime forever. It's just not, that's just not a reality. So, you know, you need some sort of mechanism to solve crimes, to protect people, ensure public safety. And, you know, like, so, yeah, I mean, I think to go back to the original point, like, to use the term abolish the police, but then be like, well, we don't actually mean that, like, you know, right now, you know, maybe like in some, you know, very, very distant future or whatever. And it's like, well, no, I mean, that's not just not how it works. Like, you need to, like, you need to talk about like the here and now and people's like actual concerns. And that's like one thing that they'll always look at you like, huh? You know, and if you can't get past that, then you're not going to get past anywhere.
It's also, I just want to say too, I think like this is also where there's like part of the problem that Matt Crisman's been talking about a lot between like the, like a certain part of the quote, like the left, I guess, that's like, you know, like all of us that are so connected to these media platforms and kind of do like these little media careers. And I'm making like, again, I'm not including, there is a serious line of people that I mentioned earlier who do a lot of work on this stuff, a lot of which is really good. And definitely everybody should, you know, read and check out, agree, disagree, and explore. And that's where the terminology comes from. But it's like, if you're just catering to like a little online market, always using the most maximalist discourse is the best marketing strategy. Yeah, but if you're thinking of how this stuff actually translates to doing things, it doesn't.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, and again, on the other side, and we don't have a Frank Luntz on our side, because quite frankly, the Democrats aren't savvy enough. They would have been workshopping a nice way to say this shit forever. They would have been like, look, you know, our ultimate goals are always the same, right? We want to deregulate everything. We want to cut taxes for the richest people and kind of like don't really have an organizing principle as a party establishment outside of that. But we know in order to achieve those goals, we got to get the energy in our party excited about stuff, but we got to make it sound palatable, right? Like we have to make it sound palatable. You know, instead of stripping women of their abortion rights, is no, we're just pro-life. We're pro-life. We're pro-life. How could you be anti-life? We're pro-life, guys. Come on. You know, and they always figure out a way to make their monstrous policy incentives sound like nice, cutesy little things. And we just don't have that on our side. And it's something that we need to think
the
about.
The right to work is a great
right
one.
To work, right. We want to destroy every single union in the country, if not the world over. And we're going to call that movement right to work. Everybody has a right to work. It's what they do. It's what the Kochs do. It's what those think tanks do. It's what those, they would have focus grouped the hell out of freaking abolish the police, right? But at the same time, the party apparatus that's supposed to be, you know, basically getting our stuff or the energy of their party to look good in public, they don't actually want none of this shit.
No.
They don't actually care. And the thing about the Republicans is like, whether they want it or not doesn't matter. It's what's going to get us to our end goal, right? It's what's going to keep us elected. It's what's going to keep our people in the streets. Doing this is what gets it going. And so, like, whatever, man. The Dems going Dem. I just want to say before we go, just a couple of things that's in the news. That's just not in the news. It's just on Twitter. Beethoven is black or was black.
Oh, man. I miss Chris Matthews, bro.
A lot of people don't know this. Wait, but what? Like all of the credible accounts of Beethoven's appearance is like at the very worst, he was mulatto, meaning he was half black and something else.
But I'll probably spend 30 minutes on TMBS on Tuesday doing this.
Okay, but Beethoven was black. And also, one of my followers hit me to another pretty cool historical correction. J. Edgar Hoover, part black.
Was black?
Part black.
Really?
Nice. Part black. Part black. Part black. So this guy was closeted gay and black.
If the sentence is not disproven there, I don't know what can disprove it.
Thank you, man. Thank you again, Mike. Welcome back to the show. I'm happy you came back energized and better than ever. Of course, Nando out in Santa Monica. I know you catching waves, man, over there.
Yeah, baby.
Cowabunga, dude.
Yeah.
Know you catching waves at the beach. Make sure you become a patron of Count the Dinks and TMPS. Make sure you subscribe to Let's Pod It Out, Nando's Entourage Pod, still going strong, still as funny as ever. Of course, make sure you subscribe to the Mailbag feed and the Black Opinions Matter feed, man. Make sure you just, you know what I mean, going out there, doing what you do, but support yourself, support your family, man, support us. We'll see you guys next week. We're out of here.